Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and along with my co-founder, Will Campion, we created this show in 2020 to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment and business worlds. Episodes are available on audio via most podcast platforms and on video via our YouTube channel. And we're active on all major social media platforms. To stay up to date with every episode, please do sign up to our newsletter at moneymazepodcast.com. And we'd like to thank you for listening. If we could ask one favour, we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about us. Thank you. If you wrote a business plan in the 1990s that was way ahead of its time, a 20th century idea that needed 21st century technology to work, then put it aside, realizing you were too early, and switch your attention to build an enterprise software business, grow it, have Goldman Sachs sell it, and then several years later return to the earlier idea, build it, and today have over 100 million athletes in 150 countries use it, people might quite rightly say bravo. And that's before I mention that you and your co-founder were fellow members of the Harvard rowing team, and you, armed with a PhD, became an economics professor at Stanford. So Michael Horvath, co-founder of Strava, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thanks, Simon. It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me to the show.
Well, I've been looking forward to this a lot. I'm a very amateurish cyclist. I'm actually preparing to try and get up Mont Ventoux in just over a week's time. I've had my Strava on and rather embarrassingly found myself in Richmond Park cycling, being overtaken by about 99% of the people in Richmond Park. However, as we prepared for this and we told people we were doing this interview, our inbox grew and it triggered, I think, the most questions we've ever received. And that beats Mike Milken and Ray Dalio. So I guess there is a reason that Strava is today the largest sports community in the world. Now, Michael, there are 21 stages of the Tour de France, and I have condensed my questions of your route to building and growing businesses into 8 stages. So hopefully you'll keep up with my pace.
Right.
Let's go with stage one. I've called it freewheeling. Was yours an entrepreneurial family growing up?
It really wasn't. My father was a doctor, a pathologist. My mother was a dentist. The one thing that they instilled in us children was the value of getting a great education and get as much of it as you can, they recommended. So not at all steering us in the direction of any particular profession. And I, from a very young age, always had some crazy idea cooking. And I was the kind of kid who would find some ad in a magazine for selling greeting cards door to door in your neighborhood. And I'd think that was a great idea. And I'd buy an inventory of greeting cards and then walk out and try to sell them and find out how hard it is to sell anything. So I was the black sheep of the family, as you say. I was just the one who was everyone else is a scientist, a doctor. I have a veterinarian. And one of my sisters is a vet. But yeah, I ended up being the one who couldn't find a real job and ended up having to create my own.
Well, I actually didn't call you the black sheep of the family. But anyway, you go to Harvard, I think around 1988. You get in the rowing team. You become the boat club captain. I mean, rowing is an intense sport. How and what did it give you for your life ahead?
Yeah, never had rowed before stepping into the boathouse at Harvard. Really was not even aware of what kind of an impact it would have on my life. If you think now to sort of where Strava is, and we can get into the story of how it actually created the seeds for Strava. But what I found there was this combination of I got to push myself and find some satisfaction in being really fit, but being around the team, being around the other people. I'd walk into that boathouse. It would be the happiest hours of every day. And we worked hard, but we also had a lot of fun. So what it taught me was this combination of when you're doing something you love to do, it can be really hard, but it can also just be the most enjoyable part of your life. And so I translate that into a lot of things later, whether starting a business, raising a family. Those are very hard things to do, but hopefully you can find the joy in it. And that's what makes it so powerful, so impactful in your life.
So as I plotted your history, I suppose I was then a little surprised that on graduating, you go into academia. I think I'm right in saying you get a PhD, and I think you teach economics at both Stanford and Tuck School at Dartmouth. Is that right?
Yeah, again, I want to sort of, if I rewind it, as like graduating in 1988, I didn't have a job on graduation. I didn't know what I was going to do. I summarily took a month and biked around Europe with my brother, and we had a great time biking from Vienna via Budapest, where our father had emigrated from, to the US when he was 25, and continuing on across other parts of Europe, across the Northern Alps of Italy and into France. And it was a great, great time. But then I come back from the trip and I'm like, what am I going to do now? Well, I found a job. I was a research assistant to a couple of my professors who were doing some side consulting work. That translated into building a small consulting firm doing economic consulting. And I thought, this is a great way to make a living, being an expert witness in these proceedings, which hinge on just really esoteric economic principles. I had studied economics as an undergrad. So I decided to go get a PhD, thinking I'll return to this consulting firm and just get paid more for what I do. Well, then at grad school, it's hard work and you learn a lot. And I got really turned on to doing research. It sort of boggled my mind that they would pay you to think of questions that you would then answer and then write the results up in a paper. And that seemed really enjoyable. And that steered me in the direction of academia. So on graduation from college, I didn't think at all of academia, but that's where I ended up. And fortuitously, I got a job at Stanford. This is 1994. So if listeners remember, either maybe you weren't born yet, but you read about it. But if you were alive, you knew that was sort of the starting point of the consumer internet. The internet had always been around for maybe 20, 30 years prior, but it had been used really in academia. It had been used in other applications, but not in consumer spaces. And so I land in Silicon Valley at Stanford right at the start point of the internet. And then, you know, sort of, we can go into what happened next. But yeah, that's how I got into academia and also how I got out of it, because getting steered away from it by the world of startups and technology.
Well, I'd call that stage two early climb. So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. Schroders is a leading provider of active asset management, advisory and wealth management services, recognized as a leader in sustainability. Few investment managers can match the combination of capabilities and global reach that Schroders offer. Across public and private markets, Schroders offers distinctive investment solutions for the diverse needs of wealth, pension and insurance clients and the other owners of long-term assets, providing excellent long-term investment outcomes when Schroders succeeds for clients, society and the wider world benefit too. Stage three, I've called getting out of the saddle. So which came first, your idea around a Strava-style business or just wanting to be entrepreneurial?
Well, we got to bring another person into the story then. It's Mark Ganey. He and I met on the crew team. He was 2 years behind me and we became friends. And after he graduated, he ended up in Palo Alto, eventually working for a private equity venture capital firm. And I ended up in Palo Alto at Stanford teaching, and this is 1994. So we're both in our mid-20s, and we are sort of awed by what's going on around us with not just that, there's this new technology that we can use ourselves. Everything from email is new to us to websites, and had never sent an email before showing up at Stanford. So all these things are sort of new in our lives. And we start just getting together pretty regularly at my office, because I actually had an internet connection and Mark didn't at his office. We would get together and talk about what could this technology do in our lives? What was going to change? How could it be used? It was just sort of fun to talk about. And in that way, it was all around us. It wasn't that we were somehow different. Many people were just energized by what was going on and started to imagine things. And once you start thinking through, well, I bet you could use it for this, you start talking to people and pretty soon you've got the makings of a business plan, if you will, or at least a sketch of what could be. So it wasn't so far-fetched that two people who had never been entrepreneurs, never really started anything, could start something and make a go of it. And that's how we got talking about what would we do if we were going to start a company, and it got us to the, maybe this is your stage four, if you will. But it got us to the thinking through of what mattered to us in our lives and what would we want to spend our time doing if we were going to build anything using the internet.
But why wouldn't it work in the 1990s?
So the idea that we sort of cooked up was what we missed the most was the boathouse. And we missed that feeling of walking in and knowing that our teammates would be there, the coaches. It would be intensely competitive, but also supportive. It was the center of how we experienced undergraduate education. We studied hard, we got good grades, but we rowed hard. And it was almost like that was the foundation on which enabled everything else. So we wanted that back in our lives, if you will. By this point, I'm married and have the first of my four kids was born and second one on the way. And life was really busy all around me, but I didn't have that center, that foundation of physical fitness. And so we imagined we could create a virtual boathouse, that experience of interacting with other people who are pursuing goals around fitness. That's something we could use the internet for, to create that environment. And so we wrote a business plan that looked surprisingly similar to what Strava is today, a way to share your workouts with other people using the internet, using digital technology. And a lot of things were unspecified, like how are you going to get those workouts into our system? What was going to happen once you did? We didn't have any of that figured out. When we went to talk about that idea with what were called technology companies back then, which were really companies that built websites, that was the state of the art. Was if you were starting a company, your first question was, how do I build a website? The skill set wasn't really well developed. Today, you can pay for services online that will build a website for you in 5 minutes. But back then, it was something you went and talked to companies to go do for you. And we tried to convince them that this was a good idea, that people would share their workouts with others on the internet. And they thought this was a very bad idea. How are you going to get the information in there? How would you make it safe for people to share with strangers? These things were uncharted territory back then in the mid-90s. The concept of a network, a social network, where, you know, today it's de rigueur that you're going to be on some platform where you're going to be seeing content from people you don't know, that didn't exist back then. And so we were talked out of the idea. And maybe luckily so, because it would have been really tough to start what is Strava today back in 1994, 1995. That would have been a tall order.
Well, another West Coast guest, Mike Milken, referred to the fact that he backed the mobile phone business when AT&T had employed McKinsey, who had said that there'll never be any more than 1 million phones sold. So much for the great wisdom of the experts. But like a conjurer, you pull a different rabbit from your metaphorical helmet and you create Connor Software. Now, how do you pivot like that? And how? Just tell us what happened to create that.
Well, this is the value of being a generalist and not having really a clue what we're getting ourselves into. Is one of the companies that we had talked to about developing this network for people sharing their workouts. They said, well, if you want a real problem to solve, we're building websites for companies, many of them in the sporting goods space, who have never had to interact directly with their customer because they've always done it through the retail store. And these are for, you know, companies like K2 Skis or Eagle River Backpacks. These were companies that were medium-sized businesses, always just sold to stores that then sold to the customer. And now all of a sudden, with having a website, they had a direct connection with their customer. They told us the problem these companies have and what they're dealing with now is the customer all of a sudden wants to have a conversation with them. They want to be able to interact with the company directly. And they're doing that by email. They're sending in questions, everything from product questions to inquiring about open jobs and things like. So there's a variety of things coming in via this email channel that the companies just simply don't have systems to be able to handle. So they told us, this web development company said, if you build such a system, I think you might be able to build a great business. We had no knowledge of customer relationship management or what real good customer support looks like. But we got thinking, since no one else is doing this yet, maybe we're not at such a big disadvantage. So we built a company called Kana Software, and initially it was called Kana Communications. It was really built around this idea that customer support would move off of telephone-based support, mail-based support, which had been the standard for decades, into internet-based customer support. And we wanted to build a system that would help companies handle this new form of interacting with their customer. So that was 1995, I believe we raised a bit of money first from my parents, then from some venture firms and got underway and built a company that by 1999 went out on the stock exchange. I did an IPO. And by 2000, both Mark and I are out of it. We're now onto other things, sort of spat out, if you will, put on the doorstep. And the company went on from there and did survive for many years. It still is around now as a privately held company once more. But yeah, it was a sort of a pivoting from original plan, but we maybe it shows you that we were more motivated to start something in this time where the world is changing so rapidly around us due to technology. We were just keen to start something, and it almost didn't matter what it was as long as it could thrive and become a successful business. And so Kana Software became it, and we tabled the idea of the network for people sharing their workouts.
And so then I read that at some point you become the CFO of a biotech company, and you have to help me understand how that fits into this picture that you've been developing.
Yeah, if your listeners are following along here, you're probably getting an image of like, I just don't have, you know, something that's called my, what's my profession? It's, well, I'm really keen on what's the idea that's captivating me at this moment. And so what happened after Kana, I went back to academia and I joined the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College in lovely Hanover, New Hampshire. It's as far away from Silicon Valley as you could possibly be in some ways, especially back then in around 2000, 2001. It is rural, you know, sort of in the woods of New Hampshire, lovely place. Yet at the same time, I had had this experience starting a company, taking it public with Kana. And there are companies starting in Hanover, New Hampshire, too. And one of them was a biotech idea, that life sciences company that was started by two professors at the Thayer School of Engineering. And they had been up and running for about a year by the time I got there and started to ask me for advice and eventually pulled me in as the CFO and head of operations to help build up that company. So there, I wasn't a founder. I was just playing a part of one of the cast of characters in the play, but had a completely different industry. I never knew anything about life sciences. This, again, is like, I was the one who wasn't the scientist in the family. If you remember, my brother was the biochemist. I was the economist and entrepreneur. So it was very interesting to see that many things translated very well between my experience in starting an enterprise software company and being part of starting a life sciences company. A lot of similarities in terms of the team you build has to be motivated by something bigger than just making money. They need to understand there's a purpose here, a mission that's larger than just everyone wanting to get rich. You need to have a really clear proposition for investors. And when you're raising capital, making that as crisp as possible is super important if you're going to have any traction raising capital. So these things were pretty applicable. And I realized that I actually knew something, unlike with starting Kana, where we're figuring it all out as we went. Here I had something to offer. So I was with Glycophy for about 4 years. And eventually the company was sold to Merck Pharmaceuticals. I think everyone was happy with the outcome. And that sort of cleared the way by 2007 to start thinking about what's next again. And then that brings up how Mark and I started talking about, remember that old idea we had back in the 90s about the network for people sharing their workouts? And then, you know, that's the starting point for what became Strava.
Right. So that's stage four, changing gears. Now, Strava means strive in Swedish. What had particularly made it possible then for you to accelerate and get this through the stage of it just being an idea?
If I go back to that point in time, it's not that Mark and I jumped right to let's start the idea we had in the 90s. We went through months of thinking through, if we're going to start a company together, what would we want it to be like? Rather than think about what it would build or do, what would be the attributes? And we came up with things like, we want it to be focused on the consumer, not enterprise. We wanted it to be a trusted brand, something that people would value in their lives beyond just the utility of using the product. We found that there were very few brands that we truly trusted in our own lives. And we wanted to try to create one if we were going to do something together. We wanted it to be fun. How's that? You know, we had had some success as entrepreneurs. We didn't have to do this. If we're going to do it, we wanted it to be really additive to our lives. And we wanted it to be something we can see ourselves doing for the next 20 years, we said. I liken it to, you know, in Silicon Valley, especially in the 90s, where things were moving so quickly, I called it the Silicon Valley Olympics. You would have an idea, you know, go get it funded. And if in 4 years you hadn't won the gold medal, which usually meant either selling the company or taking it public, well, then you're done. You're out. That was sort of the mindset of a very fast pace to big success was prized. With Strava, we wanted to build something that endured. We wanted to build something that would become a profitable business. Profitability was something we had not achieved at Kana Software. We wanted it to be something that had longevity, that we could see it lasting for decades, even 100 years, if you will. That's something that we thought would be much more suited to what we could do next. And then we started to say, what would fit that description? We explored a number of different ideas, including, you know, what is Strava today? We can go into what some of those were, everything from delivering water by bicycle, delivering, you know, sort of sustainably sourced drinkable water in a better way, because back in the 2008, 2009 timeframe, it was pretty clear with what was going on with climate change and focus on the environment that the way that we were living, especially in the US, it was not going to lead to a sustainable outcome. So we were sort of motivated to explore a number of different ideas. That got us back into thinking about what is really the value of fitness in our own lives and helping people live a fitter life. What does that lead to in terms of their life, their satisfaction in life and their ability to contribute to society? And we felt that that ended up winning in the sort of competition of ideas that we were engaged in during that time frame, ended up winning out, and that being the basis of what we then started to build that became Strava.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. The Money Maze podcast is sponsored by IFM Investors, a global institutional asset manager whose purpose is to invest, protect, and grow the long-term retirement savings of working people. Owned by pension funds and inspired by their members, they invest in what matters. As a responsible investor, IFM actively engages with their portfolio companies on issues they care about, with the aim of improving net performance whilst minimizing risk. They manage investments across infrastructure, debt, listed equities, and private equity assets. To learn more, tap the link in the episode description below. So I'm clear on the purpose you had and the principles that needed to underpin it. Take me through to the version one of the business model.
If you have the sort of the basic principle, is we want to enable people to interact around an active lifestyle. Interact, meaning share what they're doing as workouts. A principle of our experience at the boathouse on the rowing team was you would see, ironically, at the tobacco shop on Massachusetts Avenue called Levitt & Pierce, by noon or so, the coaches would post the roster for that day's workouts. Which time slot did you get and who would be in your session of the workouts? There were two or three, sometimes four different sessions each day. And you had to show up at your appointed time slot, and you'd know on that posting in Levitt & Pierce who was going to be there with you. All sorts of intrigue would ensue from that point forward. What did this mean for you? What did it mean for the team? And then you'd show up at the boathouse with those people and go through the workout, and the workout would be posted. So the principle of the idea of seeing the people and seeing what they're doing, that was just core to the experience of what motivated us while we're on the rowing team. We knew that would be part of it. But not much else. You know, if I had to think through the initial incarnation of Strava, it really was very a blank canvas on which we would now start to add a few things. And this is where, when people ask me sort of what's the way you build a great product, is you have to be prepared for the serendipitous moment when the thing that you least expected pops up and it becomes the thing that's the center of the experience. And to be prepared, it takes a lot of researching who's your customer and so forth and knowing where to look. But the serendipitous moment for us was meeting Davis Kitchell, who lived in Norwich, Vermont. Again, we're talking, Hanover is a town of 5,000 people. Norwich is a town of 1,000 people across the river, the Connecticut River from Hanover. And Davy had lived in Norwich for many years, grown up in that area. And he was tinkering around with a GPS device on his bicycle, a Garmin GPS unit that was recording his rides. And he was wondering, could he take this data, the raw data from these devices, and somehow construct a way to compare how long it took him to climb the hill from the road up to his house when he returned home from a bike ride? He thought this would be really interesting just for his own purposes. But he was working on this at the same time we were looking for something that would be the spark for the Strava experience. I met Davey on my birthday, the day I turned 40 in 2006, but we didn't really connect these two dots until around late 2007. And by 2008, we had a working prototype, if you will. We just basically all it was the basic principle of a leaderboard showing you your own times or your times compared to others on segments, on a segment of road, a climb. Today, the people who are familiar with Strava will know this is a Strava segment. This is a Strava leaderboard. This is part of what makes Strava really unique and special for some people. Not everyone is geared towards competition, and we have plenty of other things in Strava for other modes, but the leaderboard was an early spark that made Strava really stand out and special for many people. So there you go. It's sort of, you have put together the idea that you can see your friends and their workouts, and you can have this moment of pushing yourself and having some sense of performance and improvement over time by looking at your times on climbs you do around your neighborhood. That was the early basis of the Strava experience. And from there, we built what you see today.
At what point do you and your partner go, the monetization must have to happen at some point, or are you build it and they'll come?
Yeah, well, maybe this is where you do learn a few things after starting a few companies. It was from the very beginning, we knew we were going to build a freemium subscription business, that Strava would be free to use as long as you want. But the best version of Strava, which has all of the features that we're building available, is going to be part behind a subscription. And we communicated that to our early community from the very beginning. And we said, you know, we're in beta today. In the first year or so, everything was free. But we said by the end of the year, we plan to turn on the subscription, even though we didn't have very many features behind the paywall. So why did we do that? If I think back to what we learned in the 90s, there were so many companies that got started without a hope and prayer of making any money, of being able to bring in any revenue. But they believed if they just built a large enough audience that something would happen that would catalyze revenue or build value in some other way by selling the company to someone else who could monetize that large audience. And we didn't believe by 2008, 2009, we'd learned that doesn't really work. You do have to think through the business model, the structure of how you're going to bring in revenue from the very beginning and architect it into the way you build the company. So I'm very glad that we had that experience, and we had started Strava from the very beginning with that idea that it would be a subscription business. However, what we didn't know was that subscription businesses grow really slowly until they grow really quickly. So they grow really slowly because you have to, at the same time you're building your community, you're also building your subscriber base. They go hand in hand. And they almost compete with each other. The more you make free, the faster you may grow your community. And the more that you make paid, and some examples are you make everything paid, it's much harder to grow your community because people aren't willing to pay in the beginning, perhaps, and they just don't even get started. So that learning took us a long time. I would say we're still learning. Strava is still, at this point, learning how to build a great subscription business. And though our community is quite large, we're always thinking through how do we make the value of the subscription more visible, greater for everyone who wants to be active, because we believe it can really help them.
So your mission statement, if I quote it, is we're trying to build the number one sports brand for the 21st century with technology and with digital experience. And I'd just like you to unpick that a bit.
Those words came out of really where Mark and I started when we said we wanted to build a trusted brand. We thought of, well, some of the brands that we trust the most are sports brands, are the brands that have been there throughout our decades of being active people, athletes, and they're always innovating. They're always searching for ways to meet the needs of their customer. And when they stop innovating, they fade away and they get overtaken by other brands that have that ethos of reinventing and innovating to meet the needs of their customers. And so we believe that Strava, though we're a technology company, that it was really a sports brand that was what made the consumer, our customer, really attach themselves and believe in the company. It was not the technology itself. That was the enabler. But it was that we treated the customer as someone who really had goals that were important to them, therefore important to Strava. They found joy in what they did, and we made that joy. We magnified it through what we were able to do with the Strava experience. So that's the words, the number one sports brand, as opposed to the number one technology company. That seems really boring. But the number one sports brand, now we're talking. That's that trusted brand that Mark and I sought to build when before we even knew what Strava was going to be. But now that I'm sort of taking a step back and really stepped away from Strava, what I can say is that those seeds that we planted have got to keep taking root, and it's up to the next generation of leadership and to continue that going, just like it is at most companies. They eventually run out of steam with the founders at the helm. And it's the next generation of leadership that embraces that and takes it forward. And I see that happening with the current leadership we have at Strava.
And we'll come back to that. But before we started recording, we just had a quick sort of inner chat about what the Money Maze podcast is trying to do and its global reach. And you made a very interesting point, which is you've got to go beyond your domestic market almost as a priority. Now, just again, why don't you share your thinking? Because this is now a big global brand.
So Strava is 80% outside the US. We're headquartered in the United States. But since almost the very beginning, our community, the people we serve, are largely outside the US. Although the US is still the biggest market, there's a very long tail into 150 countries. And over half of our revenue is generated by consumers, our customers that are in countries beyond the top 20. So if you think about that, it's a phenomenon, I think, of what technology enables is if you get the product right, the product meets the needs of the consumer, it can rapidly scale across borders. That was very difficult for us to do with Kana software back in the 90s. It was, first of all, we were going on site to install systems into companies. That takes having teams on the ground in different places. Eventually, Kana got there too. But what the consumer side of things enables through the app stores in particular, but in general, is a broad distribution to anyone in the world who has access to the basic ingredients of the technology, a mobile phone, the internet. And so you can reach the people very quickly. It's not a guarantee that you will. And that's something that I think is really a lesson I learned specifically around like, what are the ingredients that will actually make that happen? It's not a guarantee that it will happen.
So Strava has this ability to create communities across device platforms. And I had to sort of get my arms around this. And I think it's your moat, but I'd like you to make sure that I've understood it correctly. And everybody listening gets to understand how you work with, because you've got a lot of competition out there as well.
Sure. Yeah. Lots of competition. We can talk about that. It's an interesting way to think about what's drawing the attention away from Strava. It may not be directly another fitness app. It could simply be Instagram, TikTok, lots of places where you can see content around fitness. But simply put, when you look at a product market fit, in my opinion, the most important thing is not, does this have utility? Does it do a job that it needs to do? That's important, but it's not the most important thing. In my opinion, the most important thing is that it's delightful, that it's magical, that it somehow sparks something in the user that makes them want to talk about it with someone else. I have a really great banking app, but it doesn't have any joy when I use it. I don't talk about that banking app with any of my friends. On the other hand, there's an amazing website called fog.today. It only works in San Francisco, unfortunately, but fog.today, it's just simply showing you the satellite images of cloud cover over San Francisco at this very moment. And then a loop of last 2 hours, last 24 hours. It was simple as can be. But it's magical if you're trying to figure out, is there fog right now at the beach, which often happens, especially in the summer. And so this is something I talk with everyone about. In fact, my friends are sick of me talking about fog.today. And so it's just yes, it has some utility, but it's that it's magical and joyful to use. And that's what makes it spread by word of mouth. And that's, I think, the key to getting sort of global distribution across borders. So what Strava, as you point out, by being a platform that enables, regardless of what technology you use, what you use to record a workout, you might be using your mobile phone, it might be an Android, an iOS, a Samsung, many different types, standards of phones. It might be a GPS recorder like a Garmin watch, an Apple watch, a Fitbit. There's hundreds and hundreds of different ways to get the ingredients, the data into Strava. But we're a centralized platform that enables you to interact with anyone, regardless of what they're using. And that universality, I think, has been a key part of our success and something we architected from the very beginning. If you think back in 2009, one of the choices we made was, well, we've got to ingest data from all good devices. We can't just hitch our star to one. We're not going to develop our own device. But we built a platform that now allowed anyone, any developer of a GPS device to be able to work, create the way for their data to get into Strava so that our users could use that device.
So two of the questions that came into us, which are related, is one, what's the most important lesson you've learned from other social media companies and other apps?
Having watched this over the last close to 30 years, you can never take for granted that your customer base, your consumer, your community will be there tomorrow. You always need to be thinking of investing for them for the future. So many companies have come and gone. So many experiences have come and gone that people would have thought that will never go away. It'll be here forever. So the permanence is, again, going back to what it takes to be continue to be relevant to the customer, is a commitment to meeting their needs, yes, innovating, but going beyond just what they ask you to do. You have to be thinking beyond that. No one would have asked us for Strava segments when Davey created them. No one was screaming for them. They wouldn't know what to ask for. So it's being able to go beyond just the statement of what people would like to see and really connect to something that's deeper inside them, a core need that they have. So in Strava's case, it's there's a certain percentage of the population. Thankfully, we think it's 10 to 20% of the population that wakes up wanting to be active. And they'd like some help doing that. They want to discover the world around them, and Strava can help them with that. They want to be able to see their progress over time, and Strava can help them with that. And they want to have more fun connecting with others, their friends and family, who are also trying to live an active life, and Strava can help with that. So these are the areas where we continue to push to try to meet the needs of our customer base so that we stay relevant into the next generation, into the next decade. And that's one of the things I learned over the last 30 years, is that they can never take that for granted.
I'm smiling because there's a colleague here in the offices we are today at Campion Capital, and he's just got married. And he said to me when he knew this interview was coming up, he said, "It's the first thing I do in the morning when I wake up. I open my Strava app," and I'm thinking, "Well, that's not what everybody does when they've just got married."
Well, yes.
But the second question is, what do you think for consumers is their favorite feature, and where is their, if not dissatisfaction, where is Strava yet to hit?
That's a great question. Well, so that idea of Strava is the platform at the center of your active life for anyone who sweats, or for a business that wants to interact with those people, a small business, a large brand, Strava is a platform where you can build a presence and interact with that community. So Strava is that platform that both works for business and for the consumer. That comes from many different things. So what's the favorite thing? It depends on who you are. If you are Nike, you really value the fact that Strava allows you to create clubs where you can show content and have your influencers build a presence on Strava and attract a community of Strava users around the world. If you're one of the people who is a member of those clubs, you love being able to see other people's workouts and see what they do to be active and maybe explore the routes they do because you might want to do them too. So there's, it depends on who you are to decide to define your favorite thing. But here's the, maybe, another lesson learned, I guess it would be that it's very hard to find anything in any experience that's used by even 50% of the people using that piece of software. In Strava's case, we define a successful feature is used by 20% would be a home run. The exception would be something like giving kudos, the simplest things. So a kudo is like a high five in Strava. It's a way to say, "I see your workout. I see what you did. Good job." Giving a kudo or receiving a kudo is almost universal. And that's probably the source of great joy, of fun and amusement. And it's simple to do. That's, that's the check it in the morning and see what your friends did and give them a kudo. That moment of joy is probably universal for everyone. And it's such a simple thing. It's part of the free experience. It's not something we would ever charge for because it's the core of what Strava was meant to do. It's to connect you with others around your active life.
I had three the other morning. They didn't know how slowly I'd cycle, but I was quite pleased to get them. Now, right. We're talking about cycling. I have friends who run, who use Strava. Tell me a little bit how you think about embracing other sports and how well it works outside of cycling.
Yeah, sure. And for many years, I'd say for the first 10 years, we kept being referred to as the cycling app, Strava. We're used for over 50 different sports today. And that didn't just happen overnight. As you point out, we started with cycling, and that was really intentional. Another principle that Mark and I have employed, I think, to some success over the years is it's much better, especially in the beginning, to go an inch wide and a mile deep in something. Get really good at one small slice of something before you try to broaden into other areas. And so we chose cycling as the first sport. A number of reasons why that was the obvious choice. Number one is cycling was booming at the time in the aughts. You had everything from it becoming the sort of the new golf. It's a way to spend time with friends, but be much more active, aerobically active. You had the resurgence after a few down years of professional cycling coming back in 2010, 2011, 2012. You had the Olympics in London, where cycling was a major part of how that Olympics came to life for the world. So cycling had a great trend. That's another area where people were spending money on cycling. So if we're building a subscription business, we wanted to pick a sport where it would be likely that people would find value in a service that helped you get more out of the time you spent on your bike. So all these reasons why we started with cycling, but it was never the plan to stay just with cycling, though I think we could have built a really successful business had we just stayed that inch wide, mile deep. But getting into other sports started with run was the next obvious choice. There are a lot of runners in the world. And when you have cycling and running together, even if your favorite sport might be something like tennis, you're probably doing some cycling and running to stay conditioned to play tennis. So we think with cycling and running, you get really broad coverage to cover many other favorite sport types for people. And then over the years, we've added the ability to record everything from snow sports to water sports to hiking, walking. Walking is a very popular sport on Strava. It's actually, though people might identify as a cyclist or a runner or some other sport, they also use Strava to record their walks, and they walk a lot. So walking is a very popular activity on Strava. So over the years, we've added these capabilities or the experiences around these other sports to complement the fact that people do many things to be active. To be able to serve their needs, you need to have something that is pretty accepting of whatever they choose to be active, whatever way today they choose to move. We want to be able to keep that so that it becomes the home of your active life. It's the way to keep a record of everything you do to be active.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. In times of economic and geopolitical volatility, investors will look to gold. Today, as the world navigates uncertainty and heightened risk, investors of all sorts will look to safeguard their wealth. We're thrilled to welcome the World Gold Council as one of our sponsors. Tap the link in the show notes to learn more, or visit goldhub.org on your browser for comprehensive research, insights, and analysis on the global gold market. So stage five is who else is in the peloton? And my question is, how long did you want to self-fund this before you sought external capital?
Yeah, so going back to the original premise of what Mark and I were trying to do, we believed that it would take some capital. We had some capital to invest, and we wanted to start with investing our own money into this business before we sought capital from others. And the simple reason we wanted to do that is that we recognize that once you bring in outside investors, it changes both the expectations about what the business is going to do, but also the direction it needs to go to achieve those, to meet those expectations. And we weren't quite sure where Strava would go in the end, you know, in the very getting from the starting point, were we building something that would effectively meet our needs and be a thriving business, but not necessarily develop a venture style of return? Or were we building something that could be much bigger? We weren't sure. The idea of recording workouts and tracking the workouts and sharing the workouts, the biggest question we got when we did start showing this idea to people is, well, how big can that really get? How many people are going to want to do that? This is 2007, 2008, when we were first starting to talk about the idea. Sort of the ubiquity of wanting to track something about your daily life and your activity level wasn't assured. Technology was really expensive and it was clunky. Those initial GPS watches were very big on your wrist. They weren't attractive devices at all. So there were all these open questions at the beginning. And we learned the lessons from other startups that we had been a part of or that we had invested in ourselves, that the minute you take outside capital, you bring in, like you said, member other people in the peloton. And you've got to be aware of what their expectations are. You're there to build it with them. So until we knew for sure, we wanted to keep it close. And that's why we decided to fund it ourselves for the first several years.
But then I read in one of your papers, you said something that almost no business owners seem to have the luxury. You said you get to pick your investors. How?
So in the sense that you have to look at it as you are picking your investors, even if you only have one choice, if you choose to go that route, you are picking them. And, you know, I've had the fortune of working with some really, really talented venture firms and investors in those firms. and incredibly helpful many times. And they can also be incredibly challenging. And so you're going to get both. You're going to get both the benefit, and also it's going to be another person in the Peloton. I love that expression, another rider in the Peloton with you. And so you have to pick, you have to view it as a choice. Even if the choice is, I'm not going to pick, I'm going to go it alone, I'm not going to do this. You have to look at it that way, that this isn't just the money. You're getting individuals, they have intelligence, they have expectations, they have hopes and dreams just like you do. And they're coming along for the rest of the ride. They're going to be there until they're not. So it's that idea that you look at this as just as an important a choice as who you're going to add to your team. Are you going to have a co-founder? It's just as important a choice as those, even more so.
And you'd written, it didn't have to be big, but it had to be great. And throughout this, I think there's this almost, I'm going to use the word obsessive focus on what you were building. Tell me a little bit about those trade-offs.
So this goes again to, I think, speaks to a nice segue from picking your investors and bringing in their set of expectations. Are they okay with the idea that it doesn't have to be big, it has to be great? Our starting point, if you remember, when we a trusted brand for the consumers who use it, it may not be the world. It may not be the whole world who uses what we're building. And so that principle of it didn't have to be big, it had to be great, is infused in how we build the experience. It is infused in how we motivate the team, build things of quality, make them better over time. And I'm sure there are listeners who would say, well, you know, there are things that we wish Strava would do and we wish they would improve. We hear you. We definitely hear you and we're working on it. And I know that the team has some exciting things that they're planning on launching very soon. I know there was a press release that came out recently, the last week or so, that highlighted some of those things. And it's an example of we're never done. Another important lesson in software is you're never done. You think you've launched an application, you've just started. Now that you have something out in the wild, you're getting feedback from your consumer and they're expecting that you will improve it and continue to improve it week after week, month after month, until they stop using it. It's got to keep improving. And so that's what the principle of it doesn't have to be big, it has to be great. And then the little side note is if it's great, you have a good chance of it being big too.
Now, there's been and continues to be this intriguing debate on both sides of the Atlantic about companies staying private for longer. Some of them are shunning the stock market. I know that you stepped down from CEO, but how do you think about how a company like Strava in the future, you know, where it sits and what might work better for its culture?
Yeah, the idea of companies staying private for longer, I believe it has to do with the capital markets more so than with the companies. So back in the days of Khanna, if once you got to, you raised a Series D or something, at Series D, which was probably tens of millions of dollars instead of single digit dollars, you didn't have many other choices. The capital markets at later stage were not well developed. Your only other choice was selling the company. So you had to go public. And many companies went public way too early. This is pre-Sarbanes-Oxley, if you remember. So there were a lot of unfortunate events happened as a result of companies going public way before they were ready. You know, so fast forward to today, what I believe is really the driver here is that capital markets enable companies to stay private for longer, and that's good for them. That's a benefit to the companies. And why do I say that? Well, there's a lot of, rightfully so, there's a lot of disclosure that's required as a public company. That simply is a lot of, not only is it overhead, but it reveals to the world a lot of what makes your company tick. And so being private is a competitive advantage in many cases, especially as you're trying to develop product market fit and reach the consumer and broaden what you do for the consumer. So I think that's what the fact that capital markets have developed late stage financing options between debt and equity that enable rounds that are in the hundreds of millions, even billions of dollars for privately held companies, it makes it possible for companies to stay private longer and to their benefit. You also have secondary markets that enable the fact that you're back in the 90s, you know, the only way to get your money back as an investor in a company was for it to be sold or go public. Today, secondary markets are also much better developed to enable trading of privately held company shares more broadly so that investors feel safe or say you're not so illiquid. You're still more illiquid than a publicly traded company, but not as illiquid as you once were holding shares in a private company.
And in fact, we've had the CEO of NASDAQ Private Markets and the CEO of the London Stock Exchange Group both talk about how they're facilitating that and the opportunities, which is, you know, which is a big change. Now, stage six is going off-road. The ancillary activities might be deemed to be health, nutrition, lifestyle, and you're intersecting with them. But it can be a bit bewildering, I think, for the consumer. How are you thinking about how those pieces come together?
It's a great question. I think we tend to lump all these things together, words like fitness and health and wellness, and it's all part of, well, we want to feel good. We want to have a life where we can do what we want. We want to be free of disease for sure, but that's not the definition of health. Health is that you're thriving in some way, that you're able to do things you want to do. Well, one way to look at it is these are concentric circles. The center of the circle is fitness. That's the pursuit of everything from being able to do more, be faster, be stronger. It's the idea, the concept of actively working on your condition, your capacity to move through space or to do work. Around that, the next circle is, call it wellness, things that complement fitness, perhaps, and that includes things like nutrition, sleep, stress management. These are not fitness per se. It's not the active phase. It's the complementary phase of what enables you to live an active and fit life. The next circle out, the next click out is a big one, and that's to health. So health speaks around the mitigation of risk factors, around disease, around preventative care, around treatments of conditions you have. So health is this much broader category. But why do we care about health? Because we want to feel well. Why do we care about wellness? Because we want to be fit, because we want to be able to work on our fitness. So these all work together, if you will. Strava, I would characterize this word squarely in the center on fitness. We would like to broaden, and we are, through partnerships, broadening all the time into that area of wellness. And then the broadest circle yet of health, lots of companies are starting there in that space and trying to work their way in towards fitness. Once you get out there, there's all sorts of questions in my mind around the regulatory environment, and the whole infrastructure around health in most developed countries is fraught with all sorts of challenges for any company trying to work in that space. So I like where we started, which was really around fitness, largely with an audience that you wake up and you have an intent that you want to be fit, and Strava can help you. And then we can broaden that out into the area of wellness over time.
We had an interview with Giles English, who with his brother founded Bremont, the luxury watch brand that has been very successful. And he said that it was three times longer, three times harder, and three times more expensive to build the business at. And then I read your partner said his three P's were patience, persistence, and perspective. And I wonder what you have found to be the hardest thing on this journey.
Yeah, it really brings up when I said subscription businesses are slow until they grow rapidly. It was that. It took a lot of belief in something that wasn't there yet. Yeah. So faith is the belief in things unseen and unknown. And so we had to have a lot of faith that by building an experience that we believed was worth paying for, that enough subscribers would show up, that we could pay the bills, that we could cover our costs and continue to build the service and have it continue on indefinitely for the future, so that it could become that generational brand, that 100-year brand, that you could start using Strava when you were a teenager and be there when you were in your 90s, like my mom in Stockholm still uses Strava to record her walks every day. Strava will be there for you when you reach that ripe old age and still be serving your needs. So that takes a lot of faith that by building this, the business will grow over time, that it will become something larger and be able to, you can then take that and invest in the future. And that's what we're doing today. But look at Strava, we're 15 years into the building of this company. And so when we got started, we believed that it might take that long, but we also needed to find employees, investors, partners who had that same sense of belief. And luckily we did. I give a lot of credit to the initial investors in the company, Greg Gretsch at Jackson Square Ventures, Jamie McJunkin at Madrone Capital, who believed that Strava could do that over time and put their money into that belief. And hopefully they're very glad they did.
So stage seven is leaving the Peloton. Now you step down. I think you have Michael Martin, who's come from YouTube, as the CEO now. How do you know when to leave?
That's a great question. So yes, at the start of 2024, Mike Martin joined the team as Strava's next CEO. Really glad to have him. He's off to a great start. And I've spent 8 years at two different times, 4 times each, running Strava. It's a tough job for a lot of reasons. It's also a very enjoyable, really fun job. So I wish him all the best. And I hope he's enjoying it as much as I did when I had that position. So the question of how do you know when it's the right time to leave? Well, I can't speak for everyone, but I had two goes at it, right? I stepped down once in late 2013, and then this time again in 2024. So the first time, it was a little bit different. The circumstances were different. And I'll share this really tough time in my family's life. I was running Strava. I'd been CEO for about 4 years at that point, and my wife was diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer. So this is 7 years after her original diagnosis. And not knowing exactly how long we had together, I thought initially, at least, we would be able to figure out a way that I could continue to run Strava and I could also care for her and for myself and for our 4 kids. And it wasn't obvious to me that it was time for me to step down. And you hope that you have people around you who can get you to really look honestly at the situation and make the right choice. And I'm really thankful that I did. I had my co-founder, Mark Ganey, who was chair of Strava's board, and he had a really tough conversation with me about the situation. And he stepped in to run the company, and very thankful that he did, because had I stayed in the role, it would have kept me from not just being able to care for Anna, but would have kept me from being able to enjoy or benefit from, or even, you know, find meaning in her last few years here. So she passed away in February of 2017. And if I think back to that phase between 2014, 2015, 2016, so many moments where, though Strava was always there, Strava was thriving, Mark was doing a great job leading the company, and I was tangentially involved as president, and I was sort of a good sounding board for what Mark was going through. So rolling into 2023, it was a combination of me feeling like this isn't necessarily playing to my strengths. So I was looking in the mirror and saying, you know, what Strava needs now may be something different than what I think I'm good at. And that there are people out there who are exceptionally good at running a company of this scale, scaling it to many multiples bigger than it is today. And if we found such a person who cared as much about Strava as I did, who cared as much about the mission, but had the skills and experiences that I didn't, that we would all be better off, including me. Again, this goes back to not thinking about it as like, what are you losing, but what are you gaining by stepping aside? So the principle here in 2024, I'm really separate from the company at this point. I stepped off the board. I'm not part of the management team. My only objective over what comes next is to be as helpful as I can to the leadership of the company. And that often is by staying completely out of everything.
So we've made it to the final stage, stage 8, like the final sprint. It's our virtual Champs-Élysées. So I've got some rapid fire questions for you. I noted that your father said, give before being asked. How easy is that?
Yeah. He said that the day that Anna and I got married. And unfortunately, he was 71 when he passed away. And so that statement of give before you're asked is the simplest way to acknowledge, yes, I care about you. Yes, I see you. I think this is really well applicable across both personal and business relationships.
Another comment, completely different, is trust your customer, not your investors. And I want you again, just expand that.
Yeah, well, I've had a number of times, you know, sort of starting several different companies where you have some early traction with your customer, you think you've got something, and you go try to talk to investors and they tell you it's a bad idea. They don't see the value in this. They don't think they can back it. It gets discouraging when you're getting all the no's as you're trying to raise capital. But if your customer is saying that they value something you're doing, and this goes back to the days of starting Kana, where we built a simple prototype and we put it in the hands of 2 or 3 different companies that were using it, just trying it out to see if it could help them with their flow of emails from customer support emails. And they were telling us all sorts of great things that this seemed to really meet their needs. They would like to use it more. And at the same time, we were getting all these no's from investors saying, wow, I don't see how this could be a, big thing? Won't this just be a feature of some desktop software that Microsoft builds? Why would a company buy a separate system to handle email? And so that idea of, well, had we listened to the investor, we would have quit right there. We would have shut down Kana and none of this would be here. I don't think Strava would be here. I think we would have thought we were terrible at the business of starting things and gone home, gone back to academia, done something else. But by listening, we sort of looked, Mark and I said, well, the customers aren't saying this is a bad idea. They're saying it's a great idea. So we kept going and we took more risk. We took more money from individuals with not being really clear if we could pay it back. We felt obligated, should this business fail, that we would need to. But we kept going on the belief that the customer was telling us something that they valued and they would be there. We trusted they would be there if we continued to build it, what we were building. And so eventually, it didn't take much longer. Strava was the same way, by the way. We got a lot of no's going out and talking to when we went out to try to raise money after funding the company for the first 2.5 years ourselves. We got a lot of no's. But what we were hearing from the people using Strava, the athlete using Strava, they were saying this is changing their life. This is making what they do, the time they spend being active, mean so much more. So we listened to the customer and we kept going. And then we found investors who were like-minded, who did see the value in what we're doing in both Kana, the case of Kana and the case of Strava.
I also heard you say, and for all of us who are thinking about the macro and worrying about whether it's geopolitical risks or economic slowdown, you said a big trend will swamp the cycles. So just again, please, just expand on that.
Yeah, well, this is the macroeconomist. my area of research was business cycles and the interplay between investment in technology and how technology drives long-term productivity gain. And so business cycles are ubiquitous in the history of economics. Going back centuries, we see these ups and downs. But when you step back away and you say you chart something over 200 years, you don't see the cycles. You only see the trend. And so what I mean by trends swamp cycles is if you're focused too heavily on the ups and downs, you're missing what will be the obvious thing, say 10 years from now, is when you look back on history, when you look back on the journey you've been on, you won't see the ups and downs. You'll see the trend. That's what will scream out at you from the data or from your memory. And you know the lesson maybe that we've learned many times over is there's always going to be bad news on a Monday. Mondays are just tough days. It's just like that's a given. Mark and I joke about it. Well, it's a Monday. So don't look at just the Mondays. You can't make decisions just based on what happened on a Monday. You got to look at what happened this month, what happened this quarter, what happened over the last year. There you got to start to pick up the trend and not just the dip you had on the Monday.
So we had a question from a guy called Rollo Dix. He's a second year undergraduate math student at the University of Leeds. And he says, I strongly believe the overall population fitness and health are key drivers of economic success through boosting mental acuity and focus. What has been the most successful development in terms of a real increase in hours of exercise completed with Strava?
Great question. I appreciate that. Yeah. So this again goes back to the principle that we experienced in our undergraduate days when we were on the rowing team, when we were training, and this is every day, 5, sometimes 6 days a week throughout the whole year, we were better students, better friends, better in our relationships because we had this anchor, this foundation of being active every day, nearly every day, and doing so with purpose, doing so with joy. So it was something that really we learned from a very early point in our lives that it made us better people, the people we wanted to be. And we believe we do that is what is going on with our community as well. And so we believe at Strava that we're bringing joy to people's lives and that makes them the people they want to be, that enables them to live the life they want to live. So when we see on Strava, this goes back many years now, but we did do some looking at what behavior change does Strava actually drive. And we really worked hard as you know, I'm a econometrician at heart. And so I really wanted to tease out causality versus just correlation here. And what we saw that the one thing that sticks out as someone starts to use Strava, they don't necessarily get faster or stronger, but they become more active. They spend more hours a month being active through using Strava. And people motivate people. It's as simple as that. When your friends see your activity and give you a kudo, you're more likely to want to go out and have another activity. And post it on Strava. When you give that CUDA to somebody else, you're passing it on. You're giving that sense of motivation to that friend that you see being active. And that is what drives that sense of, I want to do it more. I want to be more active. So we don't say we're building Olympic athletes at Strava. We're just simply helping people lead the lives that they really want to lead, the active life that they find brings them joy.
And a really tricky on-the-spot question. The Money Maze podcast is 4.5 years old. We're in the top 1% of global, 4 million global podcasts in 120 countries. You've talked about subscription. We've said we want to build great content, global distribution, not with a paywall. What piece of advice might you offer? We've been calling this a get-rich-slow scheme.
Right. So times are changing. I would encourage you to think about this as, you know, you're probably providing value way beyond, you know, the price of zero to some number of your people in your audience, and trying to really understand, well, who is that? What does that audience look like? Where are they located? What do they do for work? How could we build a product that's not just the podcast, that is actually derived from the same content, perhaps, that is worthy of a subscription? And I think of that as, I've seen that work extremely well, that though you built, it's a freemium business, essentially, your podcast is the free part, but this additional component of it is the part that a small number of people, a percentage, you know, maybe it's a 5-10% of your audience is willing to pay for. And I think it's a great compliment to what you're already doing. I love your show. You have some amazing people who come on board. I'm honored to be added to that list of people and be here. So, I mean, what I'm thinking through is how can you extract the key pieces from this audience, this cast of people that you've had come through, and be that's the source of what you can be charging for? Is that, what form does that look like? What does that become that's digestible and usable by people? So I'm a believer in subscription in many contexts that we don't see it today. I think we're just getting started with understanding how the consumer will accept that digital experiences are worth paying for. Some of them are subscriptions, some of them are pay per use, but the idea that this is, though it's not a physical product, it's just as important and valuable as the shoes on your feet, and you're willing to pay for it.
So two final questions, then I am going to let you go because you've been very generous with your time. What is your unclimbed peak? And I mean that in the widest possible sense, vocationally, spiritually, emotionally, geographically.
That's a great question. I'm in search of what's next for me right now. I think there is yet another stage or another race for me. And in essence, I think it comes down to, I believe I've learned something over the number of companies that I've started. I don't think it'll be related to any of them. I don't think it's going to be in the same area. But what I think is the unclimbed peak for me is the creation of something that is defined by how it fits into the customer's life in a different way. Strava's close to that. I think when your listener spoke about the first thing they look at in the morning and, you know, it's part of their daily life. It's like that for some people, but not for everyone. So building something that is sort of central to how someone lives their life, I think is something I'm searching for as the next idea. I don't know if that's a definition of the unclimbed peak, achieving that. What's driving it for me? I think it's that I believe we all can benefit from, we are looking for getting more out of our existence. And we're in a fortunate position to be able to create things relatively cheaply and more inexpensively all the time, especially when it relates to software. So again, I'm thinking about this in the context of the next 10 to 20 years, what would fit into the lifestyle of a, maybe it's a small number of people, 100,000, a million people that I could bring to life that would make a difference in their lives. Hopefully it's solving some big problem they have, it's making their life better, but it's defined less by how many people use it. So again, it's not about being big, it's about being great, but it's a core part of how they live their life. And then that would give me an incredible amount of satisfaction.
So here we go. Your final question is, which two sportsmen would you like to have dinner with?
That's a great question. So do they have to be alive?
No, they could be dead or alive.
Okay. I'm sure we're going to get some debate among your listeners for this, but I would love to have dinner with Pele. In my view, the greatest soccer player who ever lived, football player, I would put that as number one. And then maybe to complement it, because they would be such different temperaments, Bjorn Borg. I'm Swedish, or half Swedish, and growing up as a kid, know, he was loomed large in my sports world as a great player, but also as someone who had a mystique around him. So I think they're probably very different people, Pelé and Bjorn Borg, but it'd be fun to have them at the dinner table.
Fantastic. Nobody has ever suggested them. It definitely fits my generation. That's absolutely perfect. Michael, we're going to stop there. I normally summarize. I mean, there is so much that people will take from this conversation, from your thoughts about why staying private for longer can be a competitive advantage, why you wanted to be, to think about quality over size. I won't repeat lots of this great advice, but I've been looking forward to this a lot. We've done, I think, over 150 interviews over 4 years. This is definitely, for me, going to rank right up there as one of the most enjoyable, terrific experiences. So, keep enjoying the ride. We look forward to meeting in person. I'd like a final shout out to our mutual friend, Ben O'Halloran, who's a skier, biker, a cold water swimmer extraordinaire, friend of ours, who suggested that he put us together for this conversation. So thank you, Ben. Thank you, Michael. It's been great meeting you today.
It's been a great pleasure, Simon. Yes, thanks, Ben. Thanks for putting us together. Take care.